So here we are again, part of this podcast, guys. I hope everybody is having a fantastic Friday, super vibes, right? Wishing you the best for your day today. Today's a very sunny day, guys. I don't think it's gonna rain. All Guatemala looks amazing, and I hope all of you having a super amazing day too, okay? As part of our, as part of my contribution with you guys, I keep reading this amazing book, which is bringing me a lot of good vocabulary and good thoughts. Beside the thoughts, I think it's a book full of knowledge and full of solid points of views where we can not only start a new way of seeing life, right? Yes, but right, also right, we have this new way of understanding how life works. So without further ado, we're gonna get started, guys, and I hope you guys like it. Last time we were reviewing the fact of how there is conflict or the historical background on how our thoughts were led to believe or disbelief on something. Now we're going to see how all of this originated. Remember that this is like a biography or the history about culture, religion, and the way how we think, right? It's not like the way how you think per se. It's more about per se. It's a very good word. Per se. Lo escribís así. Per. Se. And they're a good word. And it's not just the way how you think per se, but it's the way how our parents were raised. Therefore, that's the way how they put all these unconscious thoughts inside of us. But let's see, where is that coming from, and since when does that exist? Without further ado, here it is, the fifth part of this podcast, and thank you very much for listening, guys. Let's keep it up. Fraud, original sin, and the unconscious. When I said fraud, I refer to Sigmund Freud. Okay, you can find more information about him. The rationalists of the 19th century were essentially optimists, and it was not surprising that they had no more taste for fraud than for the church doctrine of original sin. Their faith in the ideal of progress and the certain triumph of reason was not at all in harmony with Freud's contention that man's highest aspiration had their origin in unconscious forces of a very different character, forces to which he gave such unpleasant names as incest wishes, castration complexes, mother or father fixations, and other phrases or blunty sexual type. Nor did rationalism take kindly to so irrational an idea as that man's unconscious goal might be to re-enter the womb and revert to a condition of protected responsibility, floating blissfully in a warm, sleepy darkness. But Freud's teaching was original sin in a new garb, for it showed the unregenerated Adam behind a thin shell of reason. And if man's highest aspiration were just rationalizations of these dark unconscious forces, did not these go to prove a fundamental doctrine of the church? Did it not show that man's effort to save himself by exercise of his innate will and reason are fruitless? For humanism and rationalism had altogether neglected a mysterious factor called the grace of God, believing that the human mind was sufficiently powerful to work out its own salvation. And by the mind, they understood merely that aspect of the soul known as intellect. Now, we have seen that intellect is the thinking machine. A power drives that machine, But whatever the character of that power, the machine can only interpret it a mechanical way. I'm going to repeat that again. Now we have seen that intellect is the thinking machine. A power drives that machine, but whatever the character of that power, the machine can only interpret it in a mechanical way. Therefore, when it has to accept an irrational impulse, it rationalizes. It rationalizes it in the course of putting it into effect. When the unregenerate Adam desires blood just for the sake of blood, the reasoning machine has to find a reasonable purpose for shedding blood, however specious. And it finds it because in many ways the intellect has the most subtle power of adaptation. Subtle is a very good word. Subtle power of adaptation and almost infinite capacity for self-deception. For it's of immense importance to the self-esteem of the ego that rationalization should be convincing. Otherwise, man must admit his failure to stand above nature. Nevertheless, Friedwan doctrine arose like little sympathy until after the Great War, when it achieved sudden success, primarily through the ability of its method of psychological healing to cure cases of shell shock. But the outburst of the unregenerate Adam in the war itself made Freud's ideas much more acceptable. Though it is surprising how many intelligent people even today would refuse to admit that they have such a thing as an unconscious mind. They regard it as quite an impertinence for anyone to suggest that they do not always know why they want what they want and do what they do. Yet, they are quite ready to admit that they do not know why their bodies produce such mysterious things as cancers and all other diseases, and that they are quite unaware of what is going on in their kidneys, hearts, and bowels. Thus, if there are unconscious realms and activities in the body, it seems reasonable to suggest, if only by analogy, that there is an unconscious aspect of a mind. So basically what is Mr. Alan Watts saying about Freud is that even though the main reason that we are unconscious of the things that happens inside of our body, that doesn't mean that they don't exist. For instance, when we have a disease, let's say, for example, we have a stomachache. Sometimes we don't know what the stomachache is. However, if we do a retrospection about ourselves, we might discover that we ate something that was not good for our health, and therefore we are sick. However, most people don't understand that because they say, well, I might have a problem with my kidney, right? It's something that my mom and my dad had, and now I have to have it, right? It's like accepting the things without having the rationality to educate yourself and think by yourself why the thing is happening. Why? How does the liver works? How does the kidney works? Why do I have diabetes? Is it because I got it from my parents, or is it because I've been eating too much sugar within the last couple of years? Why do I have heart problems? The mere fact that the things that we are unconscious, that doesn't mean that they don't exist. So neglecting those things or simply not paying attention to them doesn't take out the power from them. Paying attention to the subconscious is most important than we think. Let's continue. The contribution of Jung. Jung, it's a guy. I'm going to tell you the name so you can look it up right on your own. All right. Jung. His name is Carl Gustav Jung. Right. I'm going to put the little name there so you can do your research if you want to know a little more information. When you read these kind of guys, you always have the ability to contribute your vocabulary with very abrupt words. So, the contribution of Jung. Analogy might suggest even more than this. The physical body has intimate connections with the entire material universe, most of which are equally unconscious, and might it not be supposed that the unconscious mind extends its roots far beyond the individual, having begun long before he was conceived in the womb. With much more than analogy to support this idea, Freud's pupil, C.G. Jung, propounded a theory of the unconscious which came close to the fringes of mysticism. So we can say that Jung was the student of Freud. For to him, the unconscious mind is personal only to its surface. Essentially, it is collective, racial, and perhaps universal. For Jung, found that in their dreams, modern man and woman spontaneously produce myths and symbols thousands of years old, of which they had no conscious knowledge. Thus, the infantile sex life of the individual was a comparatively unimportant factor in the unconscious. And Freud's analysis was found to be just the first important step into this undiscovered realm. The significance of the idea of the unconscious is twofold, for it reveals a natural universe on the inside of man as well as on the outside. It also raises important questions as to the character of man's real self. I have already suggested that this self lies much deeper than conscious reason and intellect, deeper even than man's individuality, which appears more and more to be an instrument animated by natural and universal forces. Now that we find the roots of the soul descending far below the personal level, we can understand why Jung describes the ego, which we ordinarily regard as our central self, as a complex of the unconscious. That is to say, it is a device employed by the unconscious mind to achieve certain results. In the same way, That is to say, it is a device employed by the unconscious mind to achieve certain results. In the same way, the apparently self-contained human body is a device employed by nature to achieve certain results. But it must not be thought that this employment of a device is necessarily purposive in the same way that the recent actions of human beings are. For human purpose may only a rationalization of natural impulse, as a reason can only operate in terms of purpose. Nice. I just went to lock down the door, the dog. Thank you. Hey. All right. So, as Jung is saying here, right, since he was like the student of Freud, he's just trying to dissect how the unconscious mind works, okay? Let's keep reading. Let's see what he has to say. To use these ideas are very new. But I said that they border on the mysticism because, in fact, they would have been well understood by many of the ancient peoples of the world. Thus, to the Hindus, man's self was identified with his individual person only because of his limited vision. They knew that if this vision could be enlarged, he would discover that his true self was Brahman. In other words, man's ego is a trick or a device called Maya or illusion to assist the functions of life. For if life is to manifest itself, it must do so in the form of separate things. Life as such is one and has no form. Nobody has ever seen life without a form. Like like you watching just the spirit. It's impossible. It needs to have a form so you can grasp it. Thus, according to the Vedic teaching of the Hindus, Brahman is one and has in itself no form. And hence, Brahman as such cannot do anything, cannot express itself. Action and expression can only be achieved when Brahman manifests itself in these devices of or forms. And therefore, they say that actions are done by the forms and not by Brahman. Parallel teachings may be found in other ancient civilizations, notably the Egyptian and Chinese. Thus, in the Shakaba inscriptions of ancient Egypt, we find the path lived as the governor in everybody, and as the tongue in every mouth of all the gods, all cattle, all reptiles, and everything else. Thus, every kind of work and every handicraft and everything done with the arms and every motion of the legs and every action of all the limbs take place through his command, which giveth value to everything. And the Chinese sage Xuan Tzu, writing about 200 BC, says, "Your body is the delegated image of the Tao. Your life is not your own. It is the delegated harmony of Tao. Your individuality is not your own. It is the delegated adaptability of Tao. You move, but know not how. You are at rest, but know not why. There are the operations of the law of the Tao." Such illustrations may be multiplied indefinitely, and there is every reason to believe that this was not just speculative philosophy. These ancient sages wrote not what they thought, but what they felt. And the intuitive and poetic quality of their wisdom is emphasized by the fact that they simply stated what they felt and seldom, if ever, argued the point. But modern man demands that his reason be convinced and expect his philosophy to be argued like a proposition in geometry among thinking people. Among thinking to us, these ideas that are very new. And among thinking people, this is a heritage some 500 years old, at least, and neither fraud nor wars and crisis will make him doubt the supremacy of reason in a mere 30 years. But this heritage has left him in an awkward position, having slain his faith in the psychologically satisfying doctrines of the church. For there is no doubt that those who can really believe in a loving God, in the redempting powers of his Christ, and in the efficacy of the confession, penance, and absolution, are essentially happy people. They feel themselves to lie in the everlasting arms of a Father whose demands on them are not too exacting, because having taken on human flesh himself, he knows its frailties, and because having understood all, he can forgive all. For these and other reasons, the Catholic Church is a master in the art of revealing man of his responsibilities. One more time. For these and other reasons, the Catholic Church is a master in the art of relieving man of his responsibilities. And where its priests do not indulge in petty politics and male terrorism, its people are among the happiest on earth. For they are able to trust life, knowing that however much it may pain them, its master will never let them down. What do they do when the pains of life become too much? The majority, I suppose, try to forget them, and civilization offers countless ways of escape. Movies, sports, magazines, mystery novels, high-speed travel, and the more time-honored remedies of wine, woman, and song. All of which, while being instructive, entertaining, and relatively harmless, do not really solve the problem. For underlying all the inescapable wearing threats of economic insecurity and war, the tense, never-rocking struggle of business, the social and economic barriers to normal sex life, coupled with the saddest misunderstanding of the art of marriage, the frustration of trying to make oneself a place in a huge, unwieldy community that cares nothing for you, one might compile quite a long list, and to know that the escapes do not work, one has just to look at faces, especially when people think they are not being watched. Then there are those who, being fundamentally religious and yet skeptical of the Orthodox Christianity, resort to the various new religions with which modern society abounds: Christian Science, Theosophy, Spiritualism, Buchanism, Rosicrucianism, not to mention those unnamed cults which revolve around such personalities as Krishnamurti, Ouspensky, Mbaba, Alice, all these people, McCrowley, you can look them up, right? They're like philosophies. And 1,000 other lesser teachers whose followers are comparatively few, but often influential. In the same category must be included those who have found a substitute for religion in one of the many schools of the new psychology, some of which are almost semi-religious in a certain sense of the world. But this category is especially interesting because although the men in the street may have little or no knowledge of such things, they are becoming increasingly popular among the intelligence and in a small, unobtrusive ways, their influence slowly extends to society as a whole. It has often been observed that members of this category and also of the churches are predominantly women approaching or past the middle of life, a class which seems to constitute a special problem in the modern world. Many were deprived of their husband in the Great War. Others have lost them somewhat early in life, or for American men in particular, are apt to die young through business worries and nervous strain. Others still are those who have failed to marry at all, or who have made unsuccessful marriages. Thus, it is often concluded that their interest in these matters is simply the result of sexual frustration. But while this may well be a contributory cause in some cases, it should be remembered that people naturally acquire an interest in religion in the later half of life, having accomplished their mundane duties, and that women are more inclined to religious feelings than men. Perceiving this as a natural phenomenon, the Hindus divided life into two main stages. In the first, men's duties consisted of artha and kama, the fulfillment of the duties of citizenship and the fulfillment of the senses, making a position in the world and establishing a family on the other hand, and the life of love, sex, and stakes on the other. When these were completed came the stage of dharma, or devotion to religion. Apart from the definite adherence of these new religious and religious psychological groups, there are innumerable seekers who find no one creed fully satisfying and who drift from group to group, seeking they know not what, unless it is that magical knowledge which will solve all problems and set their souls free from fear. Sometimes they think they have almost found it, this or that. But what a strange place to look for the secret of life. Surely it's more likely that these secrets will be found in life itself and not in doctrines and ideas about life. Some look for the truth in creeds and forms and rules. Some search for doubts and dogmas in the schools. But from behind the veil, a voice proclaims, "Your road lies neither here nor there, O fools." For the peculiar thing is that both what we are trying to escape and what we are trying to find are inside of ourselves. This, as we have seen, is almost more true of modern man than of the primitive, for our difficulty is what to do with ourselves rather than the external world. Thus, at the risk of repeating a truism, it is obvious that unless we can come face to face with the difficulty in ourselves, everything to which we look for salvation is nothing more than an extra curtain with which to hide that difficulty from our eyes. Whether salvation is sought in mere forgetting or in a definite attempt to find salvation either through religion, philosophy, or psychological healing, the same principle applies. Psychological healing in particular has been devised for the very purpose of enabling man to face himself, to accept nature in himself with all its primeval desires and fears. Oddly enough, however, many of the most fervent devotees of psychology are outstanding examples of its failure to help them. It doesn't attempt to offer comforting doctrines about this world or the hereafter, like many forms of religion and philosophy, nor does it hold our promises of power and success. It digs ruthlessly into the secret places of the heart and drags out man's most carefully guarded mysteries. And yet, one has met accredited and fully qualified practitioners of this science who appear to be anything but reconciled to themselves or to life. For it seems that even the acceptance of life can be used as means to escape it. So going back to this, guys, let's review, okay? We were discussing the fact of Freud and Jung. Who are these two characters? You can look them up in their biography, and you can, if you would really like to know more, remember, guys, reading is important. Reading will give you more. Read whatever you want. I'm just reading this because you chose it, and I never expected such a complex book. Right, when I opened this book, I thought he was going to talk about more the way how our values were, but he's talking more about how history has shaped our beliefs and our ideologies. So basically, he's just now making a point again on how religion is one of the biggest factors in our beliefs and our fears and our happiness, right? How the way how we see life is nothing more than the way how others have told us that it is. Sometimes when we want to make a change, we look for something outside ourselves to make that change. Let's say, for example, as I was mentioning yesterday, right? We want to make a change with ourselves by going to the movies or by having a conversation with somebody else. But everything goes back to the same point where the way how you make a change, it's just inside of yourself, like it says here, right? Yes, your road lies neither here or nor there, right? So basically, we try to look again for the obvious salvation of our soul or the happiness of ourselves, whether the salvation is just inside of ourselves. But the mere fact of looking inside of ourselves, they make us be trapped again. So how can I be outside the circular, the circular loop, right? This loop that makes me feel sad, happy, sad, happy, sad, happy. How do you feel is the best way to escape from it? When you feel truly yourself, what do you do to feel truly yourself? Do you like going out with your friends? Or is it the moment when you're alone? Is it the moment? Have you ever felt such happiness inside of your heart? Or have you ever woken up with such a great emotion to start your day? If that's so, tell me how it feels. And tell me how can you overcome the fact of being fearful about life and start living the life that everybody deserves. One more time, guys, I very appreciate your time, and I hope you guys enjoying this. Well, I'm going to send you the index, and let's keep it up, all right? You guys have a great and magnificent rest of your day. I wish you the best and great weekend to all.